It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In all cities, there is churn. There's industrial churn, residential churn, relic waste. And we're going to find out what those terms mean as we look at what happens when the factories and large manufacturing facilities go dark. There are urban lots where hazardous industrial facilities once operated but no longer do. In some cities, what springs up in their place on these coveted land parcels is these hip neighborhoods and redevelopment projects that seize on that old factory vibe. And that's a vibe that could have lurking hazards in the soil, in the walls, in the air. And the redevelopment is a world away from the original use of that land. So a pair of sociologists have a new book out. It's called Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. And they met as graduate students here at UW-Madison. Jim Elliott is professor and department chair of the Department of Sociology at Rice University. Jim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, Kate. Thank you.
And Scott Frickle is a professor of sociology and environment and society at Brown University. Scott, welcome to you.
Thanks, Kate. Great to be here.
Well, Scott, let's start with you. Many urban areas share a common past that may be hidden after decades of change. One is industry and manufacturing. How is that part of what makes urban areas tick?
You know, industrial growth is really sort of hardwired into the history of American cities, small and large. Industry is what makes a lot of cities' economies chug along. And so when you begin to look deeply and seriously at the sort of fine-grained patterns of industrial the ebbs and flows of industrial growth in and through and around cities, we begin to see something about, and our hope in this project was to learn something about how cities actually work by studying, a major feature of urban economic development and growth.
And you got really granular on these industrial sites, really digging into the data sets that are out there to figure out where these sites are and then what's on top of them today.
Right. So the book the study is really based on a sort of a new approach or methodology that Jim and I developed that makes very systematic use of state historical manufacturing directories. And these are directories that exist in most states for most years, dating back at least to the early 1950s. And they're really compendiums of manufacturing facilities that were operating in a state in a given year. And so for this project, we went and hit the books, so to speak, and found and extracted data from these old manufacturing directories in four cities: New Orleans, Minneapolis, Portland, Oregon, and Philadelphia. For every other year from the early 1950s until about 2008, when we stopped collecting data. And by doing that, we get, as you said, a very fine-grained picture that begins to come into view about what kinds of industries are operating in cities at particular times, where they are located, and for how long they operate in a particular place or on a particular parcel of land. By aggregating data from these directories, we can see that these patterns begin to emerge. There's spatial patterns and temporal patterns about how industrial development actually plays out over time and across space.
Jim, what are the challenges? What are your concerns that come up with having an industrial past and building on that and using parcels in a completely different way?
Right. Well, this gets back to some of the larger points that Scott was getting to. So en route to that, answering that question, it's important to realize what we do is look at cities oftentimes as places, but again, realizing that those are processes. The things in Madison, the things in Houston, Providence, are constantly going on. And one of the things that we uncovered before we got to the parcels was this realization that, you know, every year in the United States, just the reported hazardous waste that's released to land on site at points of production is over 1 billion pounds. And that doesn't include mining or other extractive, industries. And so what we have in cities with the churning that Scott was talking about is a changing of where people live, but also a changing of where industry is located. And if the average churn for a hazardous industrial facility is only 8 to 10 years and then it goes away and then gets occupied by something else, what it's doing is not just changing who's occupying that land, but it's fundamentally changing that parcel and that land, potentially, you know, leaving unknown toxins and contaminants behind. So what we wanted to do is begin to sort of really take that seriously in a way that government reporting hasn't. And so one of the things that you asked is, well, in taking that seriously, you know, it's useful to go and find out who and what is on that parcel now. And this gets into the broader processes that we wanted to talk about. So we use these state manufacturing directories that Scott talked about to identify exact addresses of hazardous industry over the past 50, 60 years. And then we went back in these four cities to sample a number of these sites and see what they had become to see if, in fact, you would sit there or at the corner and say, yes, that's a site that deserves attention. It looks like it might pose a problem. And what we found was exactly the opposite, that, you know, we would go and find a childcare facility or a mosque or a park, anything and everything that typically did not raise concern. And then from our industrial database, we were able to then go back and see that a lot of the hazardous facilities that we had identified occupying those spaces had actually ceased operation before any registration or policy denoting them as hazardous. So we have this huge blind spot historically, and the current vision is one that doesn't invite investigation. And so what we're trying to do with the site surveys that you mentioned is go out and see how ubiquitous and how hidden these things become, not just because they're buried in the soil, but because what's above it sort of erases our memory of what was there. And as neighborhoods change and as people move in and out of that space, they're unlikely to have a memory of what used to be there and raise concern. And so this gets into the broader process of change that we see going on, but oftentimes don't fully understand.
Talking with Jim Elliott and Scott Frickle, they're professors, and their new book is Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. And you can join the conversation, 800-642-1234. Do you live in an urban area with the history of manufacturing? What do you know about it? What concerns do you have about the cleanup or any waste left behind? And what do you want cities to do when it comes to managing their industrial history, their industrial footprint that's left behind? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Scott, cities we live in, they grow, they develop, as we just hear, they're always in process. What is driving this urban change?
Well, you know, the key mechanism for the sort of urban change that we're studying in this book is the use and reuse or redevelopment of urban land. So, you know, cities are fundamentally land-based. You know, we would, in sociology, we call them social formations, right? So, and land is fundamental to what cities are, what cities become. And so we are studying how land use changes over time and how different land uses are organized different spatially. That is, do they spread out? Do they contract? Do they follow routes of transportation or natural formations like rivers or topography in certain ways? And so those are the kinds of questions we're able to sort of dig into with this project. But it's really that at the heart of this book, and we argue at the heart of the nature of cities, is land use change.
And so when you looked at these four cities, New Orleans, Philadelphia, known as the manufacturing capital of the U.S., Portland, and Minneapolis. Why those cities?
We wanted to get we wanted the study to be as generalizable as possible, given the sort of high demand for a very intensive data collection that we were undertaking in this project. And so our goal was to select four cities that are in different parts of the country, that are different sizes, have different kinds of racial and ethnic compositions, but all are relatively old cities, all have a history of industrial activity, and all, importantly, we think, are river port cities. And our logic there was that historic river port cities would be places where industrial processing would concentrate. And so the we were trying to find area or cities that would sort of help us illustrate these questions that we were posing in this book. And so what's interesting about the comparison that we undertake in this project is by looking at different cities in different regions and finding very similar patterns across all four of them, we can begin to sort of think more generally about the processes that we've uncovered in this project.
And here's what we know about big cities. They suck up a lot of resources. Consider megacities, populations of 10 million or more. Reading in the book, in 1990, there were 10 around the world, topped by Tokyo, Osaka, and New York. By 2030, the number is expected to increase to more than 40, so concentrating more of our activity and waste into fewer places. The book is called Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. We're taking a closer look at urbanization with sociologists Scott Frickle and Jim Elliott as our guides, getting your thoughts on cities as they redevelop. 800-642-1234. Do you live in an urban area with a history of manufacturing? Let's talk about it. Call in, email. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show as we talk about urbanization. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So the story goes that between 2009 and 2011, sociologists Scott Frickle and Jim Elliott, they took a series of field trips to Minneapolis, to New Orleans, Philadelphia, Portland, to see for themselves. They surveyed the modern land uses where complex factories and industrial sites once ruled the land, and they were armed with database research and lots of maps, but they were on a kind of a detective hunt to learn exactly what had become of old industrial lots. Their book is Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities. And your questions and insights on rezoning, on placemaking, on urbanization, all welcome. 800-642-1234. How has industry affected the city where you live? What about the social and environmental health of the area? Do you live in an urban area with a history of manufacturing? And what do you want to know about it? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Let's go to Mark now, joining us from Wauwatosa. Hi, Mark.
Good morning. How are you guys doing today?
Good.
Well, as I was explaining when you first took the call, I'm an environmental consultant. I've been doing it for about 30 years. And part of the process of property transactions is environmental due diligence. So typically, when an industrial property or even a small commercial, even as small as a gas station, gets sold or transferred over to a party for redevelopment, there's typically a process that's called environmental due diligence, which begins with a phase one and oftentimes a phase two environmental property assessment. And so a lot of the properties that I've worked on as a consultant, there is a process that we go through before the transaction is even consummated, the deal is even consummated, in order to fulfill the obligations of protecting the human health and the environment, which is one of the DNR here in Wisconsin, one of the DNR's requirements, that we make sure that the soil issues are managed, the vapor issues are managed, the groundwater issues are managed before any development takes place. And so my question is, have you taken those factors into consideration as part of your study?
Mark, great question. Jim, do you want to field this?
Then I'll start and see if Scott can fill in if he wants to. But Mark, thanks for your question. It's a great one. And I guess I would first scope back and sort of contextualize the issue and then come forward to the present day. So one of the things we're concerned about is blind spots, that we don't really know the extent of the problem. And so in the early 80s, as you're well aware, there were federal regulations that came on board after Love Canal and other concerns about relevant contaminant wastes and soils that said, hey, we need to pay more attention to this. So there were some federal laws and some new reporting requirements for industry, and that starts in the 80s, but there are holes in that, right? So only larger facilities have to report. It only begins in the 1980s. And then when there are violations to be inspected as we move into issues of, say, Superfund declarations, it's only the larger sites that become obviously sort of targeted for more intensive regulation. So I'm getting to your question, but it's a whole series of processes by which we begin, we think, from our investigations, that the regulations that are on the books and the processes tend to focus on a very small percentage of sites that maybe deserve attention. And so when we go and look at our database that just goes from the 1950s up to the present on all these sites that might be ones of concern because of lingering contaminants, we find that the records we look at, only about 1 to 10% of sites actually have some sort of public record of the testing you're talking about. And so that means the vast majority, 90 to 95%, are not being inspected. And so we think that's an issue. And so we're very glad for people like you and for the processes that work to identify those sites. But we think that they're too little in the big scope. People are doing good work, but they're just not the resources that have been sort of dedicated to doing the type of due diligence that you're talking about across the full sweep of sites. And that's certainly true before sites, sites that might have gone out of business before the 1980s where there's not a lot of record of this. So our concern is sort of scoping out the processes and the testing that you're talking about to a fuller sweep of things. And maybe if you're going to talk about what we do is, you know, developing a policy that we might think of as a more ostrich policy. Go stick your head in that sand, in that soil, and figure this stuff out. And not you personally, but a bigger sort of, cadre of folks looking out for the public interest.
Scott, I want you to jump in there on this ostrich policy. What could be changed in our current regulatory practices?
Well, let me follow on with what Jim was saying just very quickly. This is a really important issue, something that we address towards the end of our book. But Mark, it's true that we don't actually investigate the. In any systematic way, the kind of investigation, the phase one, phase two site investigations that go on at point of sale. And I guess I want to make two points about that. One is that part of what we're uncovering in this book is what we describe as industrial churning, or the churning of land uses. And our data suggest that over the span of the six decades that we cover in this study, a single site could undergo as many as four or five different land use changes in that period of time. So our concern is really, as it relates to your question and the question of the site investigations, is what would trigger a site investigation? Certainly a gas station turning into a preschool would trigger a site investigation in anybody's book. But what about a gas station that went out of business in 1960 and became a hardware store and then became something else and then became a nursery school? It's not at all clear that those sorts of properties would trigger the kind of attention that you're talking about. The second point, though, and I think this is just a general point, is that the investigations that happen at points of sale occur within the context of a private or semi-private real estate market. Our understanding is that a lot of those reports that are generated during those processes are not public or not, or at least are not easily accessible by the public. And so it's a really murky world, the world of environmental consulting. That's, you know, it's structured by current regulations, and I guess our project raises questions about whether or not those legal structures are doing the kind of intensive work that the industrial churning in our study suggests is necessary. We don't have an answer to that question, but it's certainly the topic of a new study.
Of a healthy new study, right?
Right.
Jim, based on your work, what is your view then on the future of cities? What do we need to do while being mindful of our industrial past?
Right. Well, that's a great question. And as we found in our book, there are a number of people who are doing different things at the local level. So the response is going to be multi-layered from the federal to the state to the local level. And what we're trying to do is first, point to an obvious sort of fact, which is it's hard to deal with a problem you don't know about. So the book is really geared towards developing this new methodology that we've been talking about to track these sites and the reuse over time. And it's through this publicly available data source, these state manufacturing directories that have been produced in every state since the 1950s. So in the back of the book, if I can plug that, there is a do-it-yourself guide for how local communities or neighborhoods might go ahead and do something that we did in these four cities, in their own neighborhoods or cities, and begin to identify where sites of concern might be. So that's one place to begin to develop it. And as Scott mentioned, the other is to sort of bring this stuff out of sort of the gray area of the market. I have family members who have bought property on the East Coast, and part of their agreements are that they will basically not do certain things. They'll acknowledge the waste or the contaminants, but ask the owners not to dig and do these sorts of things. So we need less of a circumscribed private solution to this and more of a neighborhood coming up to a city, state, and federal level.
Thank you so much for joining us. Jim Elliott is professor and department chair of the Department of Sociology at Rice University. Scott Frickel is a professor of sociology and environment and society at Brown University. They're the authors of Sites Unseen, Uncovering Hidden Hazards in American Cities, as we've been exploring old industrial sites and what is built on top of them. Just ahead, Indigenous History contains a series of injustices. We'll talk about it. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.